This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A good reason to read Kevin Canty's short stories is sentences like these, in which a character describes his mentally ill mother. If you saw her on the street, you would see an ordinary woman, or slightly more interesting than ordinary, one of those well-off, independent women who approach their 50s in sneakers and naturally graying hair. You might suspect her of bird-watching, of having a visualized piece bumper sticker on her station wagon. You wouldn't imagine her naked on the bus, inviting the bus driver to have sex with her. You wouldn't think she had a knife in her purse, defense against a conspiracy she wouldn't name, afraid to say the words. Canty's debut collection of short stories is called A Stranger in This World. He always thought he would be a writer, but he spent many years not writing. He dropped out of high school, worked as a laborer, ran a business, and eventually went to grad school. He was first published in the 1992 summer reading issue of Esquire. He said that the moment he works toward in his stories is when the familiar world seems strange.
Most of us have a strong and inflated sense of our own ability to do the right thing. And I think that when people do get into trouble, when the world becomes unfamiliar, when the rules don't seem to help much, is when people discover the most about themselves. I know that has been true in my life, is that as long as everything is going along fairly well, I seem to be able to do fairly well. When things get difficult, then I find that I can surprise myself with the way that I act.
When has that happened to you?
Even as commonplace as falling in love, a lot of times you find that the rules have changed, that all of a sudden, you know, the normal parts of your life are subordinated to just where is this person and what's the shortest route between me and them. There are other times that have happened to me, and most of them are really too personal to want to talk about.
You seem to be very drawn to self-destructive behavior in your characters.
I thought you didn't have to end that right there. I am. I don't know why. I have a hard time writing about people who are leading relatively normal lives. I think that my own life right now, for instance, is fairly normal. I mean, I have two beautiful kids, and I'm married to a woman that I've known since 1976. And you know, I have a teaching job, and basically, my life would put a hummingbird to sleep. I mean, it's just dull. I think people in trouble are infinitely more interesting than people who aren't in trouble. And so that self-destructive impulse, I think, is something that I'm very interested in, because it's in some ways a war of the self against the self, the way that we can do things, and part of us knows that it's wrong, and yet we do them anyway. There are different parts of our personality, and in some ways they're at war with each other.
Have you ever been in serious trouble?
Oh, I don't know. Yes. I mean, yes. A year and a half ago, I was coming out of graduate school with no money and two kids and no job prospects. And I thought I was going down the tubes and taking my family with me. I mean, that seems fairly abstract. I mean, I was in all of the regular kinds of trouble in high school and some of the irregular kinds.
What saved you from that moment when you were out of grad school and broke and thinking you were looking ahead of trouble?
Extraordinarily good luck and some real a vote of confidence from the people at Doubleday who picked up on the book at that point and really solved a lot of problems for me at one stroke. But it was a very close thing. I mean, it's a strange thing to try to believe in yourself as an artist and to try to carry that along, and then all of a sudden to realize that it just might not work out, that you just might not be able to do this no matter how badly you want to. And we didn't go over the edge, but we were as a family sort of looking down over there and seeing how far it really was to the bottom. And it was a very frightening experience.
I want you to read a bar scene from your first story. And this is where the father takes his son to a bar that the father hangs out in all the time. The son is 17, not quite drinking age.
The bartender set a Coke on the bar in front of me and a fresh gin and tonic in front of my father. I never saw him order it. A tilt of his head, a raised eyebrow, some signal the bartender understood. He drank gin in the summer and Manhattans in the winter. His glass looked clear and inviting, and it seemed to give off a faint phosphorescence, a glow, like a picture of a saint. We turned to the game, but I couldn't hold my interest in it. The Padres and somebody else. One of those late West Coast games that don't even seem to matter to the players. I looked around the bar, curious. It was the first time I'd ever been in one of my father's places for any length of time. Everyone seemed friendly enough, and the darkness of the place was pleasant, but I didn't understand what would bring people out of their houses to come here. It was a comfortable, quiet kind of bar anyway, with a jar of pickled eggs on the counter, Slim Jim sausages, potato chips, and those little foil packs of aspirin. A few couples scattered among the tables, a knot of men at the back, drinking beer and laughing. Jet butts from the Naval Air Station, most likely. I sat on my bar stool, sipping my Coke, wondering why my father chose to spend his life here.
Is this passage based on a particular bar?
No, it's based on Bud's Bar in Prescott, Wisconsin. Yeah, no, a place I used to go in the summers to work on agricultural schools, agricultural crews, and it was really the first bar that I ever spent any time in, and it was just in some ways still is the paradigm of the American bar for me.
I like the pickle. Pig's feet along with those little foil packets of aspirin.
Yeah. We used to come in there after working for 12 or 14 hours and out in the cornfields and sit there on these hot summer nights and, you know, you knew you had to be asleep and you just sit in there drinking beer long past bedtime anyway. And it was just so, I mean, it was the one place, the first time that I ever discovered the bar as a kind of refuge from a life that, just a working class life. It's not at all hard to understand why people go to bars if you're outside working with your body in the hot sun all day. It's like, it is a kind of paradise.
My guest is Kevin Canty. He has a collection of short stories called A Stranger in This World. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Kevin Canty. Did you grow up in a working class family?
No, not at all. Father was a magazine editor, architectural magazines. All his professional life.
Because most of the main characters in your stories are from working class backgrounds.
Yeah, they are. Don't know. Beats me. I spend a lot of time in the working class. I spend a lot of time just working around people, and to some extent, these are the stories of the people that I was around when I was having ideas about stories. There's also a sense in which I think that a lot of the middle class life seems so sort of cushioned, contented. I just don't have the gift for getting through that in the way that Ann Beattie say can really penetrate through the sort of layers of comfort of the middle class life and get to the souls of her characters and make stories out of them. And I've tried, and sometimes I feel like I've almost succeeded, but most of the time I find that characters that are living a little bit closer to the economic edge have a little better apprehension of reality, or at least certainly a different version of reality.
Well, I think it's interesting that your father would edit an architectural magazine and you'd be writing about characters who live in trailers.
Sideways trailers.
But you've had a lot of working class jobs. You've worked on a construction crew. What else have you done?
Well, I ran a sound reinforcement business in Portland for many years, Portland, mm-hmm. Oregon. And that's, you know, it sounds romantic, but in fact it ends up being a lot of driving around in the middle of the night, hauling speaker cabinets to and fro. And that was the reason that I was able to go to graduate school in writing is that we built that business up and sold it. So that was really, you know, one of those good old Ronald Reagan American success stories to some extent. Except that all of our clients were punk rockers. We started off as the only sound business in town that would deal with punk shows because everybody else was afraid of them.
Did the bands blow up the speakers a lot?
They tried. And we tried to keep them from blowing them up. And it was just usually, Merry Little War, trying to see what was going on. The Johnny Thunders concert where they're using the microphone stand basses for Frisbees and throwing them around. or the early Dead Kennedy shows. Or, a lot of the early punk shows were just wild and a lot of fun.
Something else on your resume that I didn't quite understand. It says you were a Gandhi dancer when you worked for the Milwaukee Railroad. I don't know what a Gandhi dancer is.
A Gandhi dancer is a track laborer. It comes from the old days of the railroad when you'd be putting in new railroad ties, and you tamp gravel down underneath the railroad ties to keep the keep the train from pressing it down. You use a short shovel with a D-handle, like a spade with a D-handle on it. So you'd have both of your hands down around your waist around on the handle of the shovel, and you'd be kicking, tamping the gravel underneath the tie with your foot. And so it would look like a dancer. They named it Gandhi dancing. And Gandhi is the generic term for a railroad laborer these days.
Oh. So how long did you work for the railroad?
Oh, just a summer. It was the greatest summer job I'd ever had, though.
Why?
There were these lunatics that used to work there, the old railroad track guys, the old Gandhis they would live in the cars. They had these sleeping cars up there. They'd pay for their room and board. They'd get paid every 2 weeks. These guys had been on the road for all their adult lives, and they really didn't have anything. They'd go up to this little town, Wallace, Idaho, which was famous for its bars and houses of prostitution, and they'd go up there with a 2 weeks paycheck, and it was good money that we were making. And they'd come back with a can of top tobacco and $5, and just wild stories. These old guys would just go up there and tear the town up, and they'd work all summer making good money. At the end of the summer, they'd go out to Washington State and pick apples. It was the old time hobos that were working there that were really fascinating.
Kevin Canty is my guest. He has a collection of short stories called "A Stranger in This World." Why did you drop out of high school?
I was bored silly. I was reminded of this. I was just up at a conference last weekend, and it was in Asheville, North Carolina, and it was a beautiful day, and the sun was shining, and I was sitting in a hotel conference room, with 100 other people talking about the writing process, and it was deadly dull, and I was sitting there looking out the window, And I realized that I had promised myself that I would never do this again, that I would never allow myself to be sitting in a room being bored like crazy and doing something that I didn't believe in, that I didn't think was a particularly useful way to spend my time, while there was a world out there too. There's just so many things to do. There's so many other things to do. And when I quit high school, I went to work on an all-black construction crew in suburban D.C., and learned so much about the realities of life in this country just from being on the bottom for a while. I was working with kids not much older than I was. I was 17 or 18, and they were 18 or 19, who were coming straight up from the South, who were married, had a couple kids, who were trying to support a family in D.C. on a job that paid 25 cents over minimum wage. I think it was $2.75 an hour back then. And they were serious, straight people. They were really trying to make a life. They were really trying to stay on the right path. And I couldn't see how you could even possibly dream of supporting a family on that tiny amount of money. And yet to watch these people, these guys, come into work day after day, and just, they were straight. They would play it straight. They would show up. They would play by the rules as well as they could. And yet, you know, when the things got slow, those guys were the first ones to get fired.
You know how you described your writing as bits and pieces of things from your life that you've woven into a nest, making into something completely different?
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe a person or an image that's stuck with you, that found its way into a story, even though the story is unlike your life?
Sure.
Yeah.
I can give you the biography of the story Dogs, which is a story that's set in a dog pound in Tucson, and I've never worked in a dog pound, but I did actually kill gophers for a summer working for Missoula County, which is a job with some built-in moral questions, and so we were looking for a dog when we were living in Tucson, and we went out to the dog pound, and we didn't get a dog, but there was just this incessant noise. This incessant barking. It just never let up the whole time we were there. We were there for, half an hour tops. And it was driving me crazy. I mean, I had the feeling as we were driving away that I just had to get out of there. And then I thought, somebody's got that job. Somebody lives with that, 40 hours a week. And it didn't strike me as the sort of thing that you would get used to. And so that sort of stuck with me. And then I read a narrative, I think in the newspaper, about what actually happened at the dog pounds to the ones that weren't taken. And then about a week later, there was a story in the papers about how the on the night after Greyhound racing was done for the year, they found the bodies of 24 racing dogs out in the desert with their ears clipped off. The ears have got the identifying tattoos on them, and so they were just, they clipped the ears so that the dogs couldn't be identified. Mm. And for some reason, I was just really led into a consideration of the sort of moral debt that we owe to dogs. And that visit to the dog pound gave me the character and the site and the surroundings. And that, all those things, and yet what pulled it together was the character, the central character in there. And he wasn't in any of those things that it came from, but he was somebody who was there to experience those things. He was there to be the person to whom these things happen. And, you know, that was almost the entire genesis of that story.
Kevin Canty, his collection of short stories is called A Stranger in This World. He teaches at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. This is Fresh Air.